Hi, this is Imelda May, and you're listening to Walk on the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. This is Chris Shiflett bringing you another amazing episode of Walking the Floor. What's happening out there? I'll tell you what's happening with me. I'm sitting in a hotel room in Nashville, just getting ready to do an in-store today at Grimey's, the awesome, awesome record store Grimey's, and then tomorrow's my big show at the High Watt here in Nashville. But of course, by the time you hear this, that will already be done, and I'll be in a van driving down the highway, heading to Atlanta to play down there for the last night of the tour. At Eddie's Attic. That's right, man. My tour is wrapping up and I'm sad. It's been so much fun. I've gotten a lot of podcast love out there on this trip. Lots of folks coming up saying, hey, I listen to your podcast, man. Thanks for turning me on to, you know, Red Simpson. So I just want to say a big, 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 big thank you to everybody that's come out and made these shows the good time that they've all been. Some of them have been pretty surprising, man. LA, Los Angeles, what the fuck? That was like one of the best shows of the whole tour, maybe my favorite because my expectations were so low because as an Angeleno, you know, I know that we get a lot of music and we're a jaded, tough crowd and sometimes those LA shows can be tough, but the resident in LA was not tough. There was a lot of love in that room. And then New York City, holy shit, I did not expect that in New York City. Did not see that coming at all. That was a good time. And of course, Pappy's. We had a great time at Pappy and Harriet's. I mean, all the shows, they've all been great in their own way. Some maybe just a little greater than others. I expect that Nashville tomorrow night's going to be amazing. It's going to be fun. We got my man Sam Palladio's jumping on that one, doing a set. It's going to be good times. Okay, let's sell some music gear. Okay, what can I tell you about Zounds.com that you don't already know? You know that Zounds makes gear affordable. You know you can break your order up into like 4, 6, 8, 12 monthly payments. You know that the folks at Zounds are real musicians that are going to make the transaction very pleasant. But let me tell you my own personal story with Zounds. Okay, so I'm out on this tour, right? And it occurs to me before I fly out to New York, holy fuck, I don't want my Firebird to get smashed to bits on an airplane ride with its flimsy old vintage case. So I email my man Billy over at Zounds, and I'm like, dude, I'm in a jam. I need a new case for my Firebird. I need it like tomorrow. And that dude got on the phone and he starts calling around to all his people and he got me the next morning, before I even got home, there was a brand new flight case sitting there waiting for me. That's what Zounds.com is all about. They're gonna get you the gear that you need and they're gonna get it to you fast with a smile and a, there you go. So big thanks to you, Billy, at Zounds for hooking it up. That's the Zounds customer service that we know and love, people. Come on, get on over to Zounds.com. Wha-bam! Whew! Okay, let's get to the interview. All right, the morning that I talked to Imelda May, Irish singer, songstress Imelda May, she was a little hungover. Because the night before was the first gig she'd done, the very first gig she'd done with her, you know, new material. She's got a new record coming out. I think it's coming out like April 21st or something like that. Anyway, she's got a new record, kind of a new sound, a bit of a musical departure from the stuff she's done in the past. It was a little more like rockabilly. And now she's doing this other cool thing. So she came in. She was a little hungover, a little tired. I offered her a beer. She did not accept. But she was great. We got right into the swing of things, talking music, and she told me all about, like, you know, her journey from being an underage teenager playing in bars around Dublin to, like, you know, an international artist making music with folks like T-Bone Burnett, my good buddy Jeff Beck, and Ronnie Wood, amongst others. And she even does a really great version of a song of her new record called The Girl I Used to Be with her guitarist, Ollie, who is in tow for the interview. Like I said, she's got a new album coming out really soon called Life, Love, Flesh, Blood. This is Imelda May on Walking the Floor.
If I love, if I love, if I love means anything.
Still slightly drunk.
Oh, good. Well, you know, I've got a beer in the fridge. It's usually the best thing for it.
I'm saying that, yeah. But I'm not sure which I am. Yeah. I woke up feeling suspiciously fine, you know,
I'm feeling fine. My friend always used to, my buddy Spike, that sings in that band, the Gimme Gimmies, used to always say, ask me if I'm drunk. He'd say, ask me if I'm hungover. Ask me if I'm hungover.
Yeah.
I go, are you hungover? He goes, not yet.
No, I think I'm somewhere around that.
So listen, I just have to warn you, I normally print my questions out, and I did that, and then didn't bring the fucking piece of paper with me, so I'm going to do it off my phone, so I don't want you thinking that I'm, like, checking my email or something, and getting distracted, just so you know.
I don't mind.
So yeah, that's your mic, you want to check it for me, just check.
1, 2, 1, 2, do you want me to get close, or?
Yeah, as close as you want to be, yeah. you can choke up on it.
1, 2, 1, 2.
Cool.
I love your t-shirt.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, it's falling apart, this. I'm going to ask Dwight Yoakam for my money back.
Aww.
Yeah, no,
I thought you meant
you know, does that, you know, the kind they call destroyed teeth?
Oh, right, right. It's funny. Like, sometimes when I wear it, people don't see the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And they just think it says, I'm a honky, which is kind of disturbing in this day and age. They might think you're on the wrong side of things.
To,
you know what I mean? It's a song. I swear. Didn't we play, I play guitar in the Foo Fighters, and I'm pretty sure we played a festival with you outside of Dublin once a few years ago.
Yes.
Any recollection? Yeah.
Yes.
What's the one? It's like the horse track.
Yes. Leopardstown? Was it Leopardstown?
I don't know. I forget. Maybe it's Oxygen. Is it Oxygen?
Oxygen, Electric Picnic. Yeah, it's Oxygen.
Something like that, yeah.
It was a little while ago.
Yeah, it was a few years ago, I feel like. Anywho, so what's going on? What brings you to LA right now? You're out doing the big promo wind up for your new record?
Yeah, doing loads of promo, doing a couple of gigs. I did a gig last night, it went really well. It was the first gig of all the new stuff with it. My now expanding band.
Right.
Not that they're expanding, they all look really good.
Well, you never know with like that backstage writer, who knows, they could be. Over here much? Have you toured the States? Because I know you've been making records for years overseas.
Forever. Yes, I've toured here a lot. From the ground up, if you know
right.
what I mean, like from
sure.
20 people in the venue. Next time I come back, it'll be 100. Next time it'll be it's gone up and up each time I come back, which is
right.
great.
Do you enjoy that part of it, considering that you have had a lot of success overseas, to come over here and sort of be like, working for it and back down a couple pegs as compared to where you could be in other places?
I think it's great. I think it keeps you on your toes when that happens, You have to get people in. And there's a lovely vibe about it when things, because I've done that everywhere. And when you do well, it's great when you look into the audience and you see people who've kind of stuck with you from when it wasn't so well. You know, you recognize fans and just lovely. You have that, I'm sure.
Sure, too. Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Sometimes you see them go from like they're 12 and now they're 30.
Yeah.
That sort
great,
of thing.
Great, isn't it? It's a nice way of doing things.
And how do those fans, those longtime fans, like what do they think of your new record and your new sound and the new direction?
Well, it seemed to go pretty well last night. They all went a bit mental for it,
yeah,
so that
cool.
was great. The reaction was great because I just made the album that I had to make.
Yeah,
you know, you have to do that, and
sure.
you just have to follow your instinct, your gut, or your heart, and just go with it. And it wasn't a major plan of mine to change. It wasn't a strategy. It was just I just didn't feel like myself anymore, and I wanted to feel like myself again.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
So when I was writing, that all came out. And so I thought I'd lose some fans. Like, I think I'll probably lose a few. I think I might gain a few, but so be it, you know.
Right.
And how does that work? But they all reacted well last night. It was great.
Like, when you're playing live now, are you mixing in songs? Because you have a lot of records. Are you mixing in a bunch of your songs, your older songs with the new songs?
Well, that, like I said, last night was just the first one. Or we did one in London in Ronnie Scott's, but it was just mostly industry people and a few fans.
Last night was literally the first show.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I thought it was just the first show here.
No. Oh, it was the first one with as a proper gig.
Why did you choose to do it here instead of back home?
It's just the way it worked out. You know, we were doing some promo here, and then we were doing it in this venue, and somebody said it'd be good to have some fans in. And we were kind of doing what we did in Ronnie Scott's like a month ago,
right,
where it was mostly industry, and they invited a few fans in. And then it just went a little crazier where they put some tickets out and they went crazy. So yeah. I think they moved it to a slightly bigger venue, but it wasn't a big venue. And it was mostly fans, because...
Yeah.
It ended up that I did promo earlier on in the day. We did two shows in the one day. I'm hungry. My belly's rumbling. We did two shows.
The mic probably won't pick that up.
That's okay. We did two shows in the one day. So I think it was supposed to be just promo last night, but we did an earlier promo show. So it ended up just being a free-for-all, you know, and had loads of fans coming. It was great. I was a bit nervous just before going on stage, just wondering how it would go down, you know, and we'd been in rehearsals and stuff, and it was really, really great. I'm absolutely really thrilled.
Have you kept the same band with you over the years, and are you now just sort of adding to that group of musicians?
Yes, I've decided that I'd like to never make money from touring again. How can I make my overheads go up every gig? Yeah, it's like that.
Add a few lasers, some private jets. Yeah, you can. Plenty of ways to spend that money. Believe me.
So there was five of us, and there's now 10 of us.
Wow.
So yeah.
Cool.
No, my manager's having a heart attack, thinking how are we going to get everybody, you know, around the place. And
yeah,
but it's good, it's great, it's a lot of gear, and it's a lot of us, but it's really, really good. And my guys, Ollie, who's sitting over there quietly on a chair, is we've known each other for like 15 years or something like that, isn't it? And we used to be in a band together, and he's in the band now, and I've the same guys and added to them. But I'm doing only I missed your question. I did only three of the old songs last night because I just wanted to do the new album, you know. Get so excited after making it,
of course.
And you're ready to go. So did the full album and then threw in three of the old ones, and so I'll see what happens on the next gig. I've no idea.
Yeah, I haven't heard your whole new record. I've just heard the songs that are up in Spotify. I think it was three of them. And it sounds fantastic. It sounds really good. I was wondering if you could just talk about, you know, the process of making your new album. I mean, it's obviously a departure musically and...
Yeah.
Where you made it, who produced it, who played on it, just all those kind of things.
Oh, isn't it lovely to get questions about music? So you do a lot of interviews where people seem to manage not to ask about music. Do you ever get them?
Yeah, well, that was actually a huge part of the inspiration for me starting this podcast. It's like, the process that you're in right now of going out and doing promo where you sit there and do interviews all day long.
Yes.
There always turns into a theme. I can guess what it is for you right now. Like new sound, new thing. I'm sorry that I'm asking some of those same questions.
No, but it
sort of boils down to like there's five questions you get asked. And it just drives you. By the end of like one day, you're just sitting there like, how can I tell this story with enthusiasm again? Yeah. And then like 2 months down the road, you're just lying.
I know.
Started making stuff up, you know?
Oh, I know. And then
you can lie all you want in this interview, by the way. Feel free. I'm totally cool with that. If you want some water, by the way.
I'm okay. Thank you. You get crazy questions. I mean, on the last album, on the last few albums, I'd make albums, I'd produce them, I'd write them, and then you'd turn up and somebody would ask you about your hair and what shade lipstick you had, and you think, great. Yeah. So I'm so interested.
Right.
And then I change it all, so because I'm just fed up with getting asked about it, and they go, wow, you've changed your hair, let's talk about it. damned if I do, damned if I don't.
Right.
But this album, My only plan on this album when I started to write, I just wanted everything to stop. Because I think I don't know whether I was put into a box or put myself in a box, but just either way, I felt claustrophobic, you know.
Right.
And I always wrote honestly, and but you find ways of hiding stuff in there, and I didn't want to do that on this, and on other albums I wrote, I knew what album I wanted to write before writing. I knew what I'd want to do. Right. And then on the last one, on Tribal, I knew I wanted to kind of push that as far as I wanted to push it with the rockabilly and more punky. I'm a massive punk fan. And I've always loved everything blues and rhythm and blues and all kinds of stuff. And on the last one, I thought, I want to push it as far as I can go so I can step away. Mm. And that's all I knew, is I wanted just to step away and stop. And I took some time. And I had no idea what I was going to write. And I just wrote a lot. And it was really good. I did a bit of co-writing, which I hadn't done before. So I wanted to try that. I wanted to see how other people write, you know, because it can be very solitary when you're...
Yeah.
When
you're, it can also be kind of a little nerve-wracking when you... I've done a bit of co-writing myself. And, you know, when it works and when you connect with somebody and ideas start flowing, it's great. It's wonderful, yes. You know. Yeah. But you can also have those moments where it's just like the two of you sitting in a room like...
I know.
I don't really like your idea. And you don't like mine.
It's obvious,
you know.
I know. There was one guy that I we turned up and I just knew it just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
There was no connection in any way. And I just remember thinking, this is going to be a long day.
Yeah, totally.
We just had completely different ideas and everything. We went through it. And so I didn't use that one. And but the other ones went really well. I wrote with Angelo Petraglia. I did a song called Black Tears with him. Really enjoyed it. With Paul Moak, a great guy, and Patrick Davis. So I wrote with those guys, and it was really good. It's great to have somebody else to bounce ideas off. Because when I get stuck, I get stuck, you know. And then I might go back to it later, or just keep working it around. It's great to have someone's brain to bounce things off, but it's also good to have a little discipline where the day starts and finishes, where I, you know, wait for the breeze to send me the next line,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
I'll go for a walk.
There is that thing of like, sometimes you just kind of have to work through the doldrums, you know?
Yeah. So I enjoyed it and I found that interesting. So I probably did, I think I've got about five of the songs that I co-wrote on the album, so that was nice.
Yeah.
And then to my absolute horror, I play guitar badly. I play fine for writing, you know,
sure.
but I'm not a guitarist, and I'm never going to pretend I am. And then, so T-Bone Burnett produced this album.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Wow.
And
did you make it here, or did you make it?
Made it in the Village in LA. Yeah.
I just interviewed Robbie Robertson over there
cool.
a couple nights ago. Yeah,
cool.
That's a cool studio.
It's a great studio.
A lot of history in that place.
Yeah, really nice. And they're really nice people as well in there. They made everyone feel really comfortable. It was really chilled out. It was gorgeous. And T-Bone, when I finished writing T-Bone, my manager asked, who would you like to produce it? And I said, T-Bone Burnett. You know, I've been a fan of his forever. And I love his... I thought with the album that I'd just done, I was hoping that we'd match well, you know.
Right.
I wanted that beautiful, velvety, classy sound with a big dose of kick-ass and attitude that he does. You know, there's always a kind of a little twist to it that suits, you know, what I love.
Did you use his sort of A-team of players?
Yeah,
Because so I've personally never worked with T-Bone, but I hear he's like one of his great assets is that he's just amazing at putting the right people in the room to make the thing happen.
That's exactly what he did. That's what he really, really did. And I was, because I produced a couple of my own albums and I want to do some more of that, so I wanted to watch him and learn and figure out how he does it, you know. I wanted to know what he was doing. And he was saying to me that one of the things is to set it up well, like, the you know, build the fountain, get the foundations right, set the whole thing up, get the right people at the right time in the right place, and get the right vibe that everybody will get on well, that he thinks, as well as just musically, you know, just as people.
Yeah.
And he really thought it through. I could see him. He kept moving around. He had names of people he was moving all around to see what would sit. And
yeah.
He did a lot of work on that to just get it right. And get he the really right combination. Did. Jay Bellarose on drums.
Oh,
and
cool.
Zach Dawes on bass.
Hmm.
And Mark Rebo on guitar.
It was
fab.
Was there a point, like, once you got started you know, say your management or your label or whoever was listening to it going like, wait a minute, this isn't your sound. What are you doing? You can't do this. Did you get any pushback from people at all?
No. They know better.
that wouldn't have worked well.
No.
I'm guessing.
No, my manager, my record company are great, you know. I'm a strong-willed woman and they seem to... they seem to be okay with that. They just let me go. And on this album, the head of Universal, when he heard it, he said, "This is the album that I've been waiting on you to write."
Mm.
And I thought that was really nice that he did wait, you know?
Yeah.
So I just got to make the albums I wanted to. Rather, nobody ever pushed me in any way or suggested. Sure. And I think that was that I came to my own, you know, my own conclusions and moved the direction I wanted to make on my own, you know?
Yeah.
But no, they're all really supportive. They just kind of go along with what I'm feeling, which is brilliant, you know?
On the fan side of things, I mean, I think of rockabilly. I love rockabilly. I'm a huge rockabilly fan.
Yeah, I can see from your pictures on your wall.
Yeah. But I think of it as it's like a very specific genre, whereas like, you know, something like alt rock means a whole lot of different things. Where I mean, in reality, rockabilly does mean a whole lot of different things, but there's a sort of a purist mentality that goes with a lot of people that like rockabilly, like on the fan side of things.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering...
I've never been a purist.
Well, exactly. That's right. In listening to your records, it's not like, you know, wait a minute. Like, did those people already... Did you already have issue with the purists? Like, who were like, you don't sound like 1956 enough, you know, kind of thing.
No,
to where you're not really, like, worried about losing those folks as fans.
No, I think, I think they came to gigs initially and then they just stopped coming.
Right.
So as soon as Al took out his bass guitar, you know, you'd see them recoil, you know. You know, and then they just never came back.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I just want people who are open-minded. There's loads of open-minded rockabillies.
Right. Yeah,
but no, I've never been a purist. I don't mind anybody who is.
Sure.
But my way of thinking on it is, you know, anybody that I'm inspired by, certainly in rockabilly, they were all ahead of the time. They were all open-minded. They were innovators. They wouldn't have held themselves back. I mean, Eddie Cochran was a phenomenal producer. A lot of people don't know that. And he used whatever equipment he could get. He's not going to limit himself saying, okay, I have this really great mic that's going to sound fabulous, but I'm not going to use that. I'm going to use the older one.
Right.
You know, and I'm just into using the right stuff for the right song. At that time, I'm not... If a new mic sounds great, if an old, you know... ribbon mic sounds beautiful, I'll use that. Or if you get a new version that copies the old one, that sounds better. I don't care as long as it sounds good.
Yeah, as long as it gets the job done.
Let's
back up a little bit. Let's talk about growing up and what got you into music. Where exactly did you grow up?
In Dublin. In Dublin, a place called the Liberties. And it was a great place and eventful. And
eventful how?
Which
part of Dublin is that? I mean, I've been to Dublin a million times, but I don't know that I know neighborhood to neighborhood.
It's inner city, right by Guinness's brewery.
Oh, okay, sure, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right in the middle of the city. I have a big family, a crazy family, slightly insane dad.
Is that who got you into music, your family? Did you have siblings and stuff? I know for me, like I was just lucky I had older brothers that were into music ahead of me. And so that's, you know, it was just sort of preordained that's what I was going to do. Yeah, you know what I mean? I had two older brothers and that's all we did. You know, we were just like a music, we're like music jocks, you know.
How did they get into it, your brothers?
Well, through my dad. I mean, really, it started with my dad, got my oldest brother. My dad was into like Dylan and the Beatles or whatever, you know, and then later on like Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder and things like that we just thought, oh, that's so terrible. Kiss is so much better than that, you know, and then you sort of grow up and go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
My dad was onto something. But yeah, so it was just, you know, just older brothers.
That's great.
And it was the right time. It's like, you know, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and it was like the Stones and the Beatles and whatever, you know, Elvis and shit like that. Just whatever my brothers had, you know.
Same as me.
Yeah. But so I'm wondering for you, like, who was it that got you into it?
Well, we had, there was seven of us in a two-bedroom house with a one record player. So that was
what was
just
fighting over that, like, no, I'm going to play my records.
Yeah, one bathroom and one record player. So right. many fights.
Right.
And
that got you ready for touring. Jesus, that sounds like a van tour, yeah. but at home.
Yeah, 100%. And I had really open-minded parents because I'm from a working class area, you know. I've not gone to music college or anything like that and studied out. I just went to pubs and clubs and gigs and since I was I just went to them and never left, really.
And what were you listening to?
Well, I was listening to my brothers and sisters. The reason I was saying I'm from a working class area is because, you know, my parents never told me to get a real job or anything. They were always open-minded and very supportive in what any of us did. My brother decided to make canoes once or tandem bicycles, and they thought, great idea, you know. And they were always, whatever you did, if you put your heart to it, they'd say, if that's what you really want to do and you apply yourself, great idea. Fill the house with canoes. And he did. Mm. And then mine was music. But it was definitely through the record player that was always on the go, you know. So between my parents, I mean, my dad listened to, you know, Turk Murphy and big band stuff and Glenn Miller and Louis Armstrong. And Mam loved all the crooners and Bing Crosby and Judy Garland. And then my brothers and sisters, between them, there was... God, because it's a big long age group. I'm the youngest. I'm the surprise that came way later.
I was the save the marriage baby.
Oh, were you? Did it? Yeah,
it didn't. No, it was too far gone. But they tried.
Yeah, I don't know how like 2 hours sleep can ever save a marriage. But there we go. Yeah. Right. So my family, because I was the youngest, that I was lucky with all the different music that I got. So there was everything from the Specials to Meatloaf, Elvis, Johnny Cash, the Carpenters, just absolutely everything. The Rolling Stones, the Beatles, just huge amount of Meatloaf, loads of different stuff. And I absolutely soaked it all in, every single bit of it, and I loved it. And then my parents noticed me. I used to set up the record player and I'd sit with my ear to the speaker and my finger at the, you know, and if there was something somebody sang, I would repeat it over and over and over, and I used to try and copy it, and I used to literally sit like that and then I'd just keep moving the needle to rehear that bit again and again and again. I think that's when they knew
there was something going on. Get your head out of the goddamn speaker.
Exactly. And stop playing that one bit forever. let it finish.
So when did you start playing yourself or singing or, you know, being in bands, or when did that happen
16.
For you?
I was 16.
Okay.
Yeah, and my brothers and sisters were great, and my dad, they used to bring me down to these late night clubs and
drinking age is a little younger there, right?
It's 18. Oh, okay. Officially.
Yeah. Well, that's a little younger than here.
And
it's
they
21.
Used to, but I was younger again, and they used to sneak me into the clubs, my brothers, and my sister put loads of makeup on me, and they because they knew I was just crazy to go and sing, and they kind of put me in the middle of a gang of them and, okay, let's walk fast. And we'd walk in and get me in, and they'd stay with me. And my dad, as it progressed, I just got really obsessed. I think most musicians are kind of nerdy in that way, and I got obsessed. I'm sure you did.
100%, yeah.
And then I went all the time to these clubs, and it was jam sessions that they were on Monday nights around Dublin, and it was a lot of great musicians that were having their day off. Their evening off would go in for a few drinks. It was one of those, if you play, you get free drinks. So loads of people turned up. And there was Van Morrison's band, the Hot House Flowers, and the Stunning. So I got to start, you know, learning from...
like the real deal pros.
Really, yeah. And they kind of adopted me. And my dad would turn up, you know, sometimes at 5 or 6 in the morning and pick me up at the end of this session. I'd be there all night long. And he used to pick me up on his way to work and drop me off at a bus stop or something. Yeah. So, and then Ronnie Wood came in and played. Yeah. And Ronnie Wood came in and played one day.
Ronnie Wood?
Yeah. And actually, we're doing a thing together next week.
Really?
Yeah. He's texting me and hassling me because I haven't given him the keys yet. I was in the car trying to figure it out. But he turned up and played when I was only 16. And then...
What was he doing in Dublin? Does he have a place over there or something?
No.
Or was he just
so,
over there?
So what happened was then later on, when I was working with Jeff Beck, Jeff introduced me to Ronnie at a thing. And I said to Ronnie... we met before, but you're not going to remember it or anything. But I just had to say we met once before. And I started to say I was in Dublin and I was this kid when I was 16, like so long, like 25 years ago, 26 years. And he started to finish my sentence and he was going, in 16, in Dublin, you're that kid, you're that kid. And I was saying, you remember? And he said, yes, I was staying in a hotel nearby with my brother. Mm. We went in for a few beers. We ended up having the session. He said, and this 16-year-old girl gets up and starts singing blues. He said, like, really singing it. And he said, I didn't know that was you and blah, blah, blah. And he was flipping out. And I was so thrilled that he remembered. And then we stayed in touch after that.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So he asked me, would I do something with him next week? And... He's been really, really cool, but he said, I always wondered who it was, and we just stayed in touch.
It's amazing when you meet somebody like that who is an icon or a hero, you know, and then actually establish some kind of musical relationship with them.
Yeah.
It's so rare.
Yeah.
You know, in this business, it's not uncommon to encounter your heroes.
Yeah.
But to actually have like a friendship with them.
Oh God, I'm really lucky.
Get to play
lucky.
With them in any kind of regular way. You know, that's more rare.
I'm lucky. I've met quite a lot of my heroes, and I've stayed really good friends with a lot of them, which is lovely. And Jeff, I love dearly. I mean, I'm crazy about Jeff and his lovely wife Sandra, and we meet up and hang out.
I'm so
a lot.
Jealous of hearing you say that, because there was a point a few years ago. Where we just happened to be in the same place at the same time as Jeff Beck on a few different occasions. We played on SNL with Mick Jagger, and he also played the same night. And we tried to get him to come jam with us, and you just sort of pass by him backstage or whatever. And I kept trying. I just wanted to meet him so bad. You know, he's like, I'm a guitar player.
I know.
Just wanted to meet Jeff
Jeff's
Beck.
Jeff's amazing.
And he was not, he wasn't like, there was just nothing there really, and like so, and there was a few moments like that, and then there was another thing we played at right after that where there was like a shuttle. We were playing this thing in DC, and he was there for that, and I got on this shuttle at the end of the night, and it was just packed with people, and there was one seat left, and it was next to Jeff Beck. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, but by the and I went and I went, and my wife leans over to me and just goes, honey, leave him alone. He doesn't want to be your friend. I was like, God damn it, you're right. Jeff Beck doesn't want to be my friend.
Your wife sounds like a great lady.
I think I just had desperate fanboy written all over me. You know what I mean? It was like, that was like the third or fourth encounter in a kind of short period of time where I just fanboyed out on him, you know?
I love that. Your wife sounds great. That was it's wise words when somebody just makes you
stop.
Totally.
It's like she could see what I couldn't see. Oh, anyway, really, I mean, you kind of just answered it in a way. But
he plays on the album.
Oh, right. Yeah, that song's one of the ones that's up. It's beautiful.
Black
it's great.
Tears, yeah.
It's instantly recognizable as him, you know?
Yes.
Because he's one of those kind of players.
Well, he's phenomenal. And it was weird when Mark Rebo was in playing. I was thinking, God, Jeff would play. I was thinking, I'd love to get Jeff on the album, just because he's been so supportive of me early on, and I was he asked me to sing on his albums, and it just felt like, not just, you know, I wasn't doing it just to have like a big name on me. I'm just, he's such a dear friend of mine, and we've worked together a lot, and I just thought it would seem like full circle for me to have my pal and obviously guitar genius play on it. And then Mark was in, as I was thinking about this, Mark was playing guitar on it, and he started doing this stuff, and then he went, I'm feeling like a Jeff Beck vibe on this. And I was thinking, fuck, that was meant to be. And then Mark played some stuff, and then Jeff did the most beautiful solo that just nearly killed me.
Yeah.
I flew back over to England, and he played. We went up to his attic, and he played a killer solo, and then went back and put it on the album, and I was thrilled. Oh, early on, I was saying I was horrified, and you'll understand, well, maybe you won't because you're a great guitarist, So I'm a horrendous guitarist. I've enough to write to that I can write, but it doesn't flow. It's terrible.
Sure,
I can play with Bunny. And then T-Bone wanted the demos of my stuff. So I'd done a few better demos. I normally do them badly and then I'll call a proper guitarist. Can you play that, but like good?
Yeah, sure.
So I'd done a few better demos and had my band come into my kitchen and sat around doing some better stuff. And then T-Bone said, no, I want to hear the rough. I want to hear the bones of it, you know, so I can get a better vibe from where it's coming from you. And I thought, oh, dear God, no, please don't make me. So anyway, he got a few of these. And then the first time I met the band was the day of recording. We'd no rehearsal or anything. And we met in the studio that morning and they said, oh yeah, we've had your demos. And I thought they meant the better ones.
Right,
and then
right.
when somebody said, oh, let me hear that a bit. And I could hear it playing and I just like felt the blood drop down to my feet. I just was so ashamed that they were listening to that, thinking, no.
That's funny. Yeah.
I nearly died.
I think we've all had those experiences. Like where your computer goes on like shuffle and all of a sudden like one of your terrible iPhone demos comes up. You can't turn that thing off fast enough.
And you can't take it back once somebody hears that. No,
yeah, totally.
They can't unhear it.
It's in there forever.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, you talked about this sort of, but I'm wondering when your, for lack of a better word, career, like when did it start to feel like, you know, you were turning professional or this was going to be something that you were actually going to make a life out of, you know, that kind of thing?
Well,
maybe like your first record deal or whatever it was.
Probably, because I was gigging for like a long time and then I wanted to be a professional musician and then I was working crappy jobs trying to pay the rent. And then gigging in the evenings and stuff like that. And then I went to, I was in a band that was doing, it was like a swing band.
Mm.
And we were doing functions. And I thought, well, this would be better than working as a waitress. And, you know, and I got to sing with a big 10-piece band and it was really great. And then I was able to, I gave up my job and then was a professional musician at last. And I was completely unfulfilled in every way because there was nothing creative coming out of me at all. And I thought, because, you know, you think if I could only make money from music and I could just do music and you think that's it. So I was writing at home on my own. And then I was going to this band and not getting to do anything creative. But I kind of learned a lot from being in that band, from working with so many great musicians.
Yeah.
So I decided to leave that band and start up my own band and then be absolutely more broke than ever because then I didn't even have the waitressing job anymore.
Right, right.
And see, it seems to be a theme in my life. How can I not make money?
Right, right.
And then
you're very good at that.
I'm good at that, yeah. And then so I just rehearsed and rehearsed. And then I decided it was now or never. And I set up my own band with some of my friends. Al is still there and Dave and on the band. And I was probably about 30 then.
Mm.
So it was late, you know, considering I've been doing it since I was 16.
Sure.
But it was the first time I'd been doing all my own stuff. I don't know why it took me so long. Maybe I just hadn't got the confidence.
I mean, do you feel like that was a bit of a blessing too? Like, would you have...
Yeah.
Skidded off the rails in some way if you'd had the success that you eventually had, you know.
Yeah, 100%. And it also got me to be able to do what I wanted to do because, you know your own mind then. Yeah.
Right.
And then I could, you know, make my own mistakes or, you know, but you're a bit more stubborn at that point.
Right.
People can't lead you where they want. So I'll say, no, I'm doing this. Even if it's wrong, it's going to be my mistake. Or if it's right, it's going to be my success.
Right.
You know,
did you encounter a lot of that coming up? Hey, you can't play rockabilly. That's a niche genre and that'll never be commercial and blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
That
and that's actually what made me do it. Right. That's what made me delve into it more. Because if somebody tells me not to do something, it tends to make me want to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I first heard of you, it was before we had played that festival together. I don't remember who turned me on to your record, but I remember thinking, God, that is so badass that there's a mainstream rockabilly artist. Yeah. Like, God, that hasn't been the case since like the Stray Cats.
I know.
What I mean? It's been a while.
I know. And the Stray Cats are phenomenal.
I just interviewed Slim Jim.
I know him well.
Ago. Yeah, he's the great best. Guy. He's so great. Yeah.
He lovely, used to play with my ex-husband, Daryl Heim, who's a phenomenal guitarist.
Yeah.
And yeah, he came and stayed with me like a week after I gave birth to my daughter. And he was Uncle Jim. He was fabulous.
Nice.
He helped me a lot.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart. You know, we always hear about English teddy boy rockabilly culture and, you know, that scene. But I'm wondering, was there a parallel scene in Ireland happening, you know, all through all those years?
Yes.
Like, who are some of the, like, Irish rockabilly artists that I should be aware of?
Oh, well, I suppose a lot of people would have been listening to a lot of the English bands, but there was those Handsome Devils that probably did the most. They were the most successful rockabilly bands in Ireland. They were phenomenal. And they did most of the writing. But then I suppose a lot of people go and see the Polecats and the Meteors and all that. But I don't know. I don't know as much of the Irish rockabilly bands as I should have done. Because I wasn't in the rockabilly clubs. I was in... the reason being, I'll tell you why. And I kind of like this. Because Ireland and Dublin was so small at the time. It's bigger now.
It's crowded.
Yeah, when it was so small in England, when I moved over to England like 20 years ago, I was very, I was impressed and blown away that there were so many different scenes. So, you know, there's a punk scene and rockabilly scene and a psychobilly scene, and they all had their place to be.
Right.
Where Ireland was. Like, you'd have an alternative scene, and that was like one club.
Everybody got lumped together.
And everybody got lumped together, and that was where I was. And I loved that, so I got to hang out with it was the rockabillies, the psychobillies, the goths, and the punks, and that's kind of what I grew up, was all of us together listening to. I was, you know, at that, the alternative club. Yeah. And I kind of liked that it didn't, there was blurred edges to everything. You know, there was a lot of great bands, But a lot of blurred lines. It wasn't boxed off as much as it was in London, which is really cool as well. But I'm kind of glad that I grew up in that. I just listened to everything that I loved rather than just one type of thing. Yeah.
You just described my high school experience.
Really?
It's totally. Because at my high, I grew up an hour and a half north of here.
Yeah.
And there was like the senior parking lot was where all the trendy kids hung out.
Yeah.
And the junior parking lot was where all the misfits were.
I know
it was like
that.
The heavy metal kids, the punk rockers, the mods, the skinheads, the weird hippie kids, the stoners, who are like, we were all in this one little area all together, you know, but all doing, like, I was like trying to be like Hanoi Rocks, like trying to be a glam rocker. And it was like me and my two friends that were into that. And then like with all the other goofballs, you know what I mean?
It's
love
great.
That. Yeah.
I thought it was good. And my brother's a rockabilly, and his wife is a mod. I mean, that would never happen in London.
Right.
They'd never.
You can't do that. You guys
never
fight
meet.
Each other.
Yeah.
Didn't you see Quadrophenia? What the fuck are you doing?
So it was because they were in the one pub, so the mods would be on one side and the rockers on the other, and they all got on well. It was only probably about 15.
Well, so what's next for you? You're obviously just about to start your world domination tour thing or whatever you're doing. What's happening?
Just gigging. Like, there's loads of promotion and all that now, and it's good to be able to do, but I'm just wanting to gig, you know. It starts in May. Last night was so good for me. I found it quite cathartic. It was a big release because I've been talking about my music for, you know, you go through, you make it, and, you know, you get it right and make it. It's all creative and fabulous. And then you go through a period where you're just talking about music.
Right. It's just been also boring shit, just, like getting the artwork done and signing off on this and that and the other. There's so much busy work.
Beep,
you know?
Beep, beep, beep. Yeah. And I'm doing lyrics. We want lyrics written out. We don't know what you're saying.
Right.
We want to print them out.
Yeah.
So I'm doing all that. So the gig is just, it's just brilliant. Just, I could just let off some steam, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So I just want a gig and tour, and I've no world domination plans. I just want it to do well, you know?
Yeah.
And enjoy myself.
I'm sure it will.
I'm hoping it goes good, but if it doesn't, I'm happy with the album that I've made.
Yeah. Well, that's all you can do.
Yeah.
Be happy with your art.
Yes, yeah. I'm going to have lots of... I'm finding I'm not getting time to sleep a lot. And if I am mumbling, it's because I'm trying to figure out whether, I'm still slightly drunk or hungover. One hasn't kicked in yet.
That beer's sitting in the fridge and it's nice and cold. I know it's a little on the early side, but I won't judge. You know, because you're probably still jet lagged, so it's really like early evening for you, right?
I blame it, but at the moment for me, I'm doing, you know, you're doing late nights, and you know, gigs, and then you have to do promo early in the morning, and that just doesn't sit well together.
I'm sure you
have to be articulate like at 9 in the morning after.
You've probably long ago figured out that the people that run your career, my apologies, of course, it never take for, you know, into consideration like sleep for you, or like, you know, the you might have to go rehearse to learn your songs, or you know, any of that stuff.
I know, it's funny. I've had Emily in the office back home, my manager, she was wanting something from me, and she was wanting like pick a song for this, and they wanted you to talk about the song, and then there was a deadline for it, but I was just so involved in it, you know, and you go through listening to songs, like I never just pick one, I'll listen, and then I'm going through my phone, then I was getting my records out, and I was listening to, you know, Heartless Bastards and Blake Mills and John Grant, and going through all of these thinking, oh, I love that song, I love that one more. She was texting me saying like it's 11:05, the deadline was 11, and I had to remind her that I am not a business worker. I can't do that all the time. That
right.
You have to let me just ramble a little, otherwise I wouldn't be able to write albums.
Right.
So, you know, that there has to be a bit of give in that, because I'm not good with doing a 9-to-5
right.
deadline, and I try my best, but it's like trying to force a circle through like a square hole, you know. It's
not what this is.
It's not. It doesn't come naturally to me at all. Yeah. So I just said to her, I'm really involved in this song. Just give me a minute and I'll get you the best bloody song.
Yeah.
Just don't make me be one of you.
I've noticed that for years, that people love like wacky artists and the things that they do to a point. Mm. And then they want like, well, why can't you act normally?
Yeah, I know.
You know? Like, but if I could act normally, I wouldn't be doing this for a living.
I think people often, you know, it's become music business sometimes, has become, and you've been doing this a long time, and so have I. I mean, you've been flying high forever, and so you've seen more of it. But sometimes, you know, music business and the business can take over a little bit too much. And, you know, I think musicians, there are a lot of people involved, and at Lisa, too, is sitting beside me. She's in the business side, but she's so creative. It's insane. And there's a lot of creatives, you know, involved in this industry, but you have to be allowed to be slightly insane to be able to be creative, you know.
And
I just have to try and remind them that, you know, I'm not quite as normal as I maybe should be, but then who is?
Right. Now keep being slightly insane. I don't know if you feel
I'm
like
I'm rambling
it.
Now I'm so sorry.
No, it's great. No, I love the rambling. So rambling sorry. Is good. Rambling is what you hope for when you do one of these podcasts. That's the podcast gold. I don't know if anybody mentioned, but you know, sometimes people play a song. If you want to play a song, you can play a song. If you don't want to play a song, you know, not everybody does, and that's fine too.
Why not? Well, Ollie's sitting over there looking good.
Damn straight.
Is your guitar in the car?
You could use this one if you want, or
you want to do some
own, whatever you want to do. Oh,
sure. I know.
Yeah. I don't know if it's tuned.
Let's do this.
Once upon a time, a Dublin girl ran free, round the cobblestones, round pubs and homes, as rich as she could be. Swimming in the Irish Sea, climbing the Bray Head. Her lips were warm with pots of tea, chips and buttered bread. Fed love from mom and dad. They raised her up. They made her fly, they gave her roots and wings. As time moves on, years go by, she missed those simple things. She's the girl I be. The playgrounds all came down, and we mourned our factory. Times were tough, but I had enough. I had my family. Life kicked in with all its might, but my strong heart wouldn't break. I got kicked around and broken down. I took all that I could take. You raised me up, you made me fly, you gave me roots and wings. Time moves on, years go by, I miss those simple things. And the girl I used to be.
So much better than anybody is supposed to sound at 10, whatever it is in the morning. That was fantastic. Thank you.
I was in the middle thinking.
It didn't show. Say hi to Jeff Beck for me when you see him.
I will do. Tell him he needs a new friend.
There you go. Yeah, that was Imelda May and her guitar player, Ollie, doing a great acoustic version. A Walking the Floor exclusive, if you will, of The Girl I Used to Be from her forthcoming album, Life, Love, Flesh, Blood. Make sure you go onto imeldamay.co.uk and find out when that's coming out, when she's playing shows, everything that you need to know about Imelda May. And then you can get on over to Twitter. You can check her out at @ImeldaOfficial. On the Twitter. And you know, hey, one little reminder, my record's coming out next Friday, April 14th. It's called West Coast Town. You can get on over to the iTunes store still and pre-order it and get your bonus track. Or just wait till Friday. You know, whatever you want to do, I'm cool. While you're in the iTunes store, make sure you listen to all the old episodes of Walking the Floor. They're all in there. They all live there. I don't know if I mentioned this in the ramble, but this is the 80th motherfucking episode of Walking the Floor. It's some kind of milestone. 80 episodes. Goddamn. We'll see you next week on Walking the Floor. This has been your pal, Chris Shiflett, signing out. Adios, amigos!